the main difficulty I find for the Western mind, Western ego mind, is the paradigm shift from the belief in the ontological reality of the world as a self-standing physical reality into which one is born, rather than realizing the world as a dream within consciousness and the self as an unknowable consciousness that is transcendent of the world. But once that shift has been made, then there really are no further obstacles to sustaining the freedom that that paradigm shift gives. Because once there is a realization that one is not the character that one is playing, then all of the characters, anxieties, and emotional issues all drop away. And not only is the self realized, but the non-duality of duality and non-duality is attained, so that the character also surrenders and realizes the self. But it's not the character that first realizes the self, it's the self remembering that it's not the character. Because the self is always self-realized. And the character does not reach the self, but the self penetrates into the character with its revelation of itself, which is the grace that is given to the character by one's self. And without that grace that you give to your character, the transfiguration and the liberation will not be attained. So it is that union of duality and non-duality that is the key to that final attainment of freedom. And if you read Sri Ramana, this is the main point that he is always emphasizing to every visitor. Just this, make this one paradigm shift, and then all the dominoes fall spontaneously. There are no other questions or doubts or worries or issues, because all the thoughts, all the questions are the character's questions, not that of the self. And the character, being unreal, can never find its way out of the labyrinth that it is. But the self can give the grace that expels all the thoughts and the emotions out of the character through the presence of your being, without doing anything. So I hope that's clear. So if you will allow me, I was going to read a few more selections of Brahmana from the talks. And I think basically these selections reiterate the point that I was just making from Ramana. So a Mr. Shastri arrived, and he had a doubt about, which he said had been cleared on reading a commentary on Atmavidya, a book by Shankara. But the doubt was, how can the world be an imagination or a thought? Thought is a function of the mind. The mind is located in the brain. The brain is within the skull of a human being who is only an infinitesimal part of the universe. How then could the universe be contained in the cells of the brain, right? So this is the current belief system, I think, of the majority of the people in the West, and you see how the educated Indians have been contaminated by it, right? Because this man was a philosophy teacher at the Madras University, right? So he was not, however, an Indian philosopher. He was a Western philosopher. And I think that's one of the results of colonialism, unfortunately. And so Sri Bhagavan had to give a very in-depth answer, but I'll read some of it without going into all of it. He says, so long as the mind is considered to be an entity of the kind you just described, the doubt will persist. But what is mind? Let us consider. The world is seen when you wake up from sleep. It comes after the I thought. The head rises up, the mind becomes active. But what is the world? It is objects spread out in space. Who comprehends it? The mind. Is not the mind which comprehends space itself space? This is a very deep point. What is your mind except the space of awareness in which those objects appear? And the space of your mind is the real space that you have projected, the mind has projected, as being outside of the body that is identified with as if it's the source of consciousness. And the word space in Sanskrit is akash, okay? So, but akash means not only space, but it also means ether. And nowadays, they have rediscovered that ether is, in fact, a reality, right? The Einstein denied ether, and he was proven to be wrong, and now ether is recognized, as is the plasma state of matter, which is that state that is superconductive, electromagnetic, and is the basis of the electrical nature of the entire universe that is interconnected through that power. And there is also another power that is underneath that is structural to the ether that is referred to as scalar waves. I won't go into all of that, but it is basically an ether-based theory. So Ramana says the mind is the mental level of ether, manakasha, which is the subtler level of it, which is contained in an even more subtle level, the transcendental or chidakasha. And the mind is thus the ether principle, the akasha tattva. Being the principle of knowledge as well, jnana tattva, it is identified with ether by metaphysics. Considering it to be ether, the akash, there will be no difficulty in reconciling the apparent contradiction in your question. Pure mind, shuddha manas, is akash, space or ether. And when it's understood as space, it's all containing. When it's understood as ether, it's the vajra power of transmitting energy through the entire field of the cosmos, which is all interconnected and quantum entangled, meaning it doesn't go just at the speed of light. It is instantaneously present at all points. Whatever is interconnected is immediately affected by any change in any manifestation, any node of itself, right? So the dynamic, the rajas and the tamas aspects of mind operate as the gross objects and activities and energies of the world. Thus, the whole universe is only mental, but mental in a stepped down way. So more and more congealed and dense aspects of the mind are referred to as material or energetic in the rajasic level. Again, consider a man who dreams, he goes to sleep, and he locks the door so nothing can intrude, and yet when he dreams, he sees a whole world in which people live and move and seems to be a self-standing world. But did that panorama get in through the doors? No, it was just unfolded by the mind. How could the brain hold a vast country like appears in the dream in its tiny cells? This must explain the statement that the universe is a mere thought or a series of thoughts. And then a rebellious Swami asked, "Yeah, but I feel a toothache. Is that only a thought?" And Ramana says, "Yes." And then he says, "Yeah, well, why can I not think that there's no toothache and then cure myself?" And Ramana says, "Well, look, when you're engrossed in other thoughts, one doesn't feel the toothache. You can actually forget about it if you're busy in other things, or even if you're in deep meditation. When you sleep, the toothache isn't felt." And he says, "Yeah, but when I wake up, the toothache is there again." Ramana says, "Well, such is the firm conviction you have in the reality of the world that it is not easily shaken off. But the world does not become for that reason any more real than you are yourself as an individual," right? So you are the toothache, in a sense, as Ramana is saying, you know, because you believe you are this body that has teeth and has aches, but that's a thought. And if you can really get rid of that thought, there won't be any pain. You know, that's been discovered by hypnotists for a long time. And in fact, in India is where it was proven. The first surgery was done without anesthesia in India because the British who were doing the surgery, you know, there was a shortage of ether, actually, is what they were using in those times. And they turned to hypnosis, and they could put people in such deep states they could do total surgery of major kinds without any chemical anesthesia whatsoever. That's still done in China with acupuncture, which puts them in the same kind of a trance state, and they do major surgery. And in the West, one of the major things that kills people in surgery is an overdose of the anesthesia. So that, you know, a little bit more than putting you to sleep will kill you, right? And it's, you know, micro, you know, grams of difference can make the difference between whether you come back from it or not. You may not care that you don't come back from it because you're in a blissful light, you know, in an out-of-body experience, but nonetheless, the anesthesiologist is going to get sued up the yin-yang by the relatives. So, but in any case, the point is if you can do it with hypnosis, you can obviously achieve this with meditation, and if you are self-realized, there's going to be less and less concern with pain. And even if it's there, it's there without it being traumatic. So, and then the guy asked a question, "Well, you know, there's a Sino-Japanese war going on right now, and if that's only an imagination, could Sri Bhagavan imagine the contrary and put an end to the war for us?" And Ramana says, "Well, the Bhagavan of the questioner is as much a thought as the Sino-Japanese war." And he puts an end to this satsang, I think. So the point being that once you understand that the world is a thought, and whether there's a war going on or whatever is simply part of that thought being collectively believed in by the entangled particles within the field is going to create the phenomena that will seem to be long-lived, but the moment that no one observes a phenomenon, it really does not exist, as the quantum physicists have grudgingly admitted. Okay, and then a few days later, this is on the 8th February 1938, three women from New Zealand arrive and with similar questions. And one asks, what's the best way to work for world peace? Ramana says, what is world? What is peace? And who is the worker? The world doesn't exist in your sleep. It's a projection of your mind in the waking state. And it's therefore nothing but an idea. Peace is the absence of disturbance. The disturbance is due to the arising of thoughts in the apparent individual, who is only an ego thought rising up from pure consciousness. So to bring about peace means to be free from thoughts and to abide as pure consciousness. If one remains at peace oneself, there is only peace all about. Okay. Now try that experiment. You may not believe it. If you're not in peace yourself, you'll say, but look at all those people arguing and unhappy and suffering. Well, but go into the state in which you are in total peace, and you will see that those characters are simply playing their part in the dream, but no one is suffering, because there's one self that is manifesting all of this, and that self is at peace. And then here's an interesting question for all the ethically minded people. The woman asks, if it is a question of doing something one considers wrong and thereby saving someone else from a greater wrong, should one do it or refrain? And Ramana says, what is right and wrong? There's no standard by which to judge something to be right and another to be wrong. Somebody might consider that very nihilistic. Opinions differ, he says, according to the nature of the individual and according to the surroundings. They are, again, ideas and nothing more. Do not worry about them, but get rid of thoughts. It's getting rid of thoughts that put you in the right. If you always remain in the right, then the right will prevail in the world. In other words, when you are in the state of self-realization, you are in attunement with the Tao, the will of God, that is the perfect intelligence behind all of this, and your the actions of your character will be accurate in relation to God, which is the only standard of right and wrong, that it could be anything more than a relative imagination. And then one of the women asks, what should one think of when meditating? And Ramana says, what's meditation? It's just the expulsion of thoughts. You are perturbed by thoughts which rush one after another. So hold on to one thought so that the others are expelled, and then expel that one. Continuous practice gives the necessary strength of mind to engage in that practice. So you have to practice it in order to get the practice to succeed in the holding of that one thought, the I am or the who am I, and then the letting go of that. Okay, let's see, I'm going to skip a little bit. One of the ladies was not satisfied with his answer and asked for further elucidation. He then pointed out that to see wrong in another is actually one's own wrong, right? Projected onto the other. The discrimination between right and wrong is the origin of sin, which is what the Bible says as well, doesn't it? So one's own sin is reflected outside, and the individual in ignorance superimposes it on another. The best course for one is to reach the state in which such discrimination does not arise. In other words, you don't see differences, you don't judge others, and you remain in peace. So do you see right or wrong in your sleep? But you exist in your sleep. So be asleep even in the waking state. Abide as the self and don't be contaminated by what goes on around. Moreover, he went on, however much you might advise others, the hearers will not rectify themselves and act in a way that's right according to you. So be in the right yourself and remain silent. Your silence will have more effect than your words or deeds. That is the development of willpower. That's interesting. Willpower is silence. It's not some ability to keep doing something, except silencing the mind. Your silence, this is the development of willpower, and then the world becomes the kingdom of heaven, which is within you. Okay. And he summarizes, the fact is this, the world is only an idea. That was Schopenhauer's philosophy too, by the way. What do you say? Are you within the world or is the world within you? This is the question that will decide whether you're able to achieve self-realization. I'm adding that. Ramana didn't say that last sentence. Okay. So I'm going to skip a bit and go to another day, but with the same people. The truth is that the self is constant and unintermittent awareness. Okay, this is important. Constant and without any breaks. Self-realization has to be without any fall into ego. Meditation is life itself. It's not something you do. It's not a hobby. It is the realization of that awareness that is beyond the world and is your only real self. So, the object of your inquiry is to find the true nature of the self as awareness. Practice inquiry as long as an illusion of separateness is perceived. If you think you're someone trying to meditate, then there is effort to be made. If once realization arises, there is no further need for inquiry. Inquiry is meditation. And the question will not arise. Can awareness ever think of questioning who is aware? Awareness remains pure and simple. All right, it's not a complex entity. It's simplicity itself, it's purity, and it is without any kind of doubts or any question about its nature. And therefore, he goes on, the body's doing work does not interfere with awareness. Work seemingly external does not obstruct the self-awareness, and the work will be realized to be not separate from the self or obstruct the uninterrupted awareness of the self, which is one without a second and which is not an individual separate from the work. Okay. All right. That's enough for that particular dialogue. I'll read a few more short ones. This 13th February, 38. Ramana says that the non-dual idea is advised, but not Advaita in action. All right. Interesting point. He says, how will one learn Advaita if one does not find a master and receive instructions? Is there not duality then? So, but it's also true that if you're in the state of non-duality, then by definition there is no action, because it means you have realized that the world is within you and nothing, you're not doing anything, nothing is happening. Just pixels lighting up on the screen, but no activity. Okay, Ramana read a letter out that arrived to describe an event. A Brahmin boy working in a household, and this was in the local area apparently, a Brahmin boy working in a household went to sleep as usual. In his sleep, he cried out. When he woke up, he said that he felt his prana going out of the body through the mouth and nostrils, so he cried. Soon after, he found himself in a dream where he is dead and the soul taken to Vaikuntha, where God Vishnu is surrounded by other gods and devotees with prominent Vaishnavite marks on their foreheads. And Vishnu says, "This man should be brought here at 2 o'clock tomorrow. Why has he been brought here now?" The boy then woke up and he related his experience to others. And the next day at 2 o'clock, he passed away. Okay, so this is actually not an uncommon type of experience. And nowadays, when they're reporting more and more of these near-death experiences and those kinds of phenomena, these sorts of stories, you can find actually on the internet very commonly and with credible witnesses. But this is how it happens. Now, for him, it was Vishnu who he saw. Maybe someone else dying is going to see another god or goddess, you know, in charge. But that's still part of the imaginary nature of the soul with the ego's traces present that will also then die be replaced simply by the light. Okay, and now this same woman says, my attempts at concentration are frustrated by sudden palpitations of the heart and accompanying hard, short, and quick breaths. We would now say she's having a panic attack, right? I don't think they had that concept, or she didn't at that time. But clearly she's very anxious. And then my thoughts also rush out and the mind becomes uncontrollable. Under healthy conditions, I'm more successful and my breath can come to a standstill with deep concentration. I had long been anxious to get the benefit of Ramana's proximity. And then when I came here, I fell ill. I couldn't meditate, and so I got depressed. And now I've made a determined effort, but I'm troubled by these short, quick breaths. And so now I'm sad. I'm about to have to leave, and I achieved nothing by coming here. So I'm more depressed than ever. You see, that's why, you know, don't waste your time, you know, going on these pilgrimages. You're going to be haunted by your ego no matter where you go. You've got to turn within. So anyway, she says she's totally depressed now. And what does Ramana recommend? And he says, well, this thought that I'm not able to concentrate is an obstacle. Why should the thought arise? Can one remain without thoughts, she asked, 24 hours a day? Should I remain without meditation? And Ramana says, what is the meaning of hours? You know, it's a concept. This question, again, is prompted by your character's thought. I added that, by a thought, but it's not your thought, right? Your nature, he says, is peace and happiness. Thoughts are the obstacle to realization. One's meditation or concentration is meant to get rid of that obstacle, not to gain the self, because you're never apart from the self. So anyway, he goes on with that. But if you're depressed, it's a thought that you're depressed. And then that thought will make you depressed. If you think you're anxious, you will be anxious. If you think you're a particular kind of person, you will act that way, and then you'll make it true, because consciousness is making everything appear the way it is. So you have to get to your root thoughts, which make up the belief in the character that you're playing, and then change that character or eliminate it and realize the self of the character, which has no such qualities as anxiety or depression or any other limitation. So he says the origin of depression and all other suffering is identification of the body with the self. The disease is not of the self, but of the body ego. And the body itself is just a thought. So the lady left, but she didn't look happy, apparently. But I don't think Ramana, you know, cared about that. And then in the next satsang, someone tells a story about a local man who was a cripple, and he was, you know, crawling. He couldn't walk for, you know, I don't think ever. And one day he was crawling along on a path, and an old man suddenly appeared before him and said, "Get up and walk. Why do you move on your butt like that?" And the guy got excited, and involuntarily he rose up and he walked. And after going a short distance, he looked behind him to see the stranger who had said that, and he wasn't there. Couldn't find him. But he continued to be able to walk. He came back to the village and told about the incident, and they were all shocked to see him walking. But they didn't find the man. But then later, it said that a girl from the local school had been kidnapped and was being robbed of her jewels by thieves. And suddenly, an old man appeared on the scene, and he forced the robbers away, rescued the girl, took her home, and then he disappeared and was never seen again. So that's the kind of thing that happens in Tiruvannamalai, which, you know, makes it an interesting place to live. But it also happens wherever you are, if you're in the right state of consciousness, that your karma has earned an intervention by the Lord of Life. Okay, someone asks, how can I know the power of God? Ramana says, well, you say, "I am," don't you? That's it. What else can say "I am" except God, who is "I am"? One's own being is his power. The trouble arises only when one says, "I am this or that, I am such and such, I am not God." So don't create that thought. Just be yourself, that's all. And of course, this isn't too satisfying to the visitor either. He says, "Yeah, but how do I experience bliss?" And Ramana says, "Well, just be free of thinking I'm not now in bliss." Right? Anandi knows that. She's in bliss. So that is to say, free from all modes of mind, to be with only one mode of mind, which is awareness, to the exclusion of others. But the visitor says, "Yes, but the bliss must be experienced." And Ramana says, "Bliss consists in not forgetting your being. How can you be otherwise than what you really are? And it is also to be the seat of love. Love is bliss." And so here the seat is not different from love. So, again, what it all comes down to is believing that you are separate from the self, which is the bliss of love, the light of pure awareness, and the freedom from any effect that the illusory world could have, so that you remain in a state of complete peace and serenity and empowerment. And all it takes is stop the thinking process of the character. And it will stop when you realize you are not the character and its thoughts are not yours. Until you realize that its thoughts are not yours, you won't stop its thinking, because you will believe it's your thinking. But it is only impersonating you by using the word I. But its I is only a thought. It's not the real I am-ness. So you can only know the real I when there are no thoughts. Okay? So you're all self-realized, and I have done my work. Retreat is over. But the floor is open if your characters have any questions.
This day. Question about the toothache. I'm trying to tie it in with the teaching that you gave for the Anarchapulco festival. I'm not sure what it was.
And the mockery.
This idea that the world of matter or the world of objects is, I'm trying to remember how you put it last night, but that what we are resisting, what we can't own about our own consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And if the toothache persists, granted that it won't persist if one doesn't believe oneself to be a being with the toothache, what is it there for? What is it teaching one?
Well, it, like any symptom, it is symbolic, but I think its symbol would be different for each individual, right? I mean, teeth have a lot of symbolic meaning. It's what we bite with, right? You can be very aggressive with your teeth. They're fangs, you know? And so one can create an ache because one feels one's power of aggression is no longer potent enough to protect you. One could feel like you can't chew things and retain them and understand things, because teeth also represent that ability to really consider deeply, you know, what's going on and the value and the reality of certain questions. So it can have a different symbolic meaning for different people. And it can also simply represent an oral stage pain, you know, of needing the breast in whatever way that would appear in one's life, and feeling the lack of that and how painful it is to not be able to fill the lack and the emptiness in one's heart. So it can also be that, but probably many more things. And so the dentist should be aware of all those possibilities, and before they do, you know, any invasive work on your teeth, they should try to get rid of the symbolic meaning of it, and then maybe they don't need to use any anesthesia or, you know, even fill a cavity, so because it's usually the heart cavity that has to be filled. But I doubt that too many dentists will take up that project. So I hope that answers it for you.
Yes, and with regards to also Ramana, Nisargadatta, both had cancer, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, their bodies did.
Their bodies did. And in that case, was there a symptom Was there a symbol that could have been understood to cure it, or was it a function of karma?
Ramana had no interest in curing it. He was ready to leave. Apparently, he took on other people's karma in order to get out, and because he was done, and he wasn't affected by it. Someone came who was an Ayurvedic doctor who had a very potent thing, and all the people around him wanted him to use the allopathic doctors. So he said, "Okay, give this to somebody else who needs it," and that person was healed of their cancer. And when he died, he helped someone else be saved. He didn't care. He was completely out of it. With Nisargadatta, it's a little different because he was this chain smoker, right? And he had throat cancer, and there may well have been a link to an addiction that he couldn't get rid of and all of that. But I'm not going to psychoanalyze Nisargadatta, so I have no judgment about that.
Thank you.
Toothache?
No aches.
Okay, that's good.
The timing of what you read tonight was interesting. In the last couple of days, I had an experience at home where I realized where I was sitting in the house. I could see my reflection from every angle, like in front of me, to the right and to the left as well. And so I was talking to myself in the reflection. And when I look into a mirror, it's immediately obvious that I'm not the body. Like that form is light. That seems obvious. Mm-hmm. But disidentifying from the mind is a different thing. So I guess I'm looking at it from the perspective of like the chit jada granti, where the I thought is identified with the body. So how is it possible that I can know that I'm not the body, but I don't realize that I'm not the mind? Is it a matter of recognizing that all is mind, like what you were saying, but that identification shifts from the body to I'm not sure what, maybe nothing or everything. And what is that state? Because it seems a little crazy that I could realize that I'm not the body, but I can't realize that I'm not the mind.
The reason is you have fused the signifier with the signified, okay? In the same way that when people read to themselves, they usually have to sub-vocalize the words. Mm-hmm. So they read very slowly at the same speed that I am reading out loud. I read to myself if I'm reading that way. Mm-hmm. And there are courses in speed reading that say you don't have to do that. You could look at the whole page and you could actually get all of the signified out of it without having to read all the signifiers and pronounce them, right? Mm-hmm. It's a matter of training, but most people aren't trained in that. And if you did that, you could get through it. Of course, if there's a really deep thought, it might not be something you would go through very quickly. You would still sit with it, but it wouldn't require all of that. So in the same way, our minds, we're kind of sub-vocally reading to ourselves an idea as if we need those words to get the idea. But in fact, the idea comes first and then the words. And if we stay with the idea, it's just a pure aha that doesn't require any signifiers, you know. And they are just like a long-form explanation of what you got instantaneously. But because you haven't recognized your ability to speed read your own consciousness, you go very slowly and linearly through your own mind and then finally get it, you know, after some long process of thinking. But it's not actually necessary.
So it's possible that I could, let's say, read through a whole book, ignore the thoughts that I'm not getting it, get to the end of that and actually have perhaps even related to it at the level of the signifier instead of
the signifier. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, it takes a lot of training to do that. Otherwise, you know, you're wasting your time. And I there are probably books or like, let's say, a poem. I wouldn't want to do like that because, you know, the rhythm and the sound quality of it is part of the work of art. But a lot of writing isn't about that. It's prose, and it's about ideas and a logical argument, let's say. And that would not require, you know, enjoying the rhythmic patterns. You know, Shakespeare, you might want to enjoy the iambic pentameter or something, you know, the metaphors. But you can get the ideas without having to go through that lengthy process. And the more you train yourself to do that, then the more packed your awareness can be with information and intelligence that isn't in the explicit order of reading all the signifiers to yourself, but the implicit order of the idea, which is just an instantaneous aha. Okay? And that comes, you know, as you meditate, often you will suddenly get an idea. And then you may write for 10 minutes to put the idea on paper, but it all came instantaneously, right? So you can have an idea. Imagine the mind of God has an idea, and the whole universe exists, all of time and space, in one instantaneous idea. That's actually what's going on.
Do you think that the sensor chooses moments to let information through when it's least likely that it's going to be retained? So, for example, every morning when I'm watering, there's a lot of thoughts that are probably more interesting than what happens at any other moment in the day, and I'm trying to record them, but I'm also very busy at that moment. Mm-hmm. Is it a time of day thing, or like what
no, you're in a kind of meditative state when you're doing it, right? So there's actually less resistance from the sensor at that time, but then it'll stop you from remembering it and writing it later on. But yeah, usually it's only in meditative states that one has good ideas. And most scientists or composers or, you know, artists say that the idea came to me in a dream or a meditation or in some place, some state in which my ego wasn't present. So that's why the more you meditate, the more intelligent you'll be, and the less plodding and linear your thinking will be.
Thank you.
I think the issue of dealing with not only toothaches, but any aches is going to become more urgent because the world's medical establishments are in a state of collapse. I don't know if you're aware of that. And a lot of them you wouldn't go to anyway because they're going to mandatorily jab you or do something worse to you, you know, if you go. So, you know, I don't think anyone can any longer depend on the medical system, certainly in the Western world, to be there for them when the social collapse happens. And there won't be drugs and anesthesias and all of that. So the more we can be in that state in which we can be free of pain through meditation, the more secure we will be. But to depend on living near a hospital or a clinic or something like that when they may shut down and be in bankruptcy because the whole system is bankrupt, I wouldn't depend on that. I would depend on being one with God. And I think that's something that should give us extra serious motivation, if nothing else does. Okay, please.
Hi, Shunya. I have a question from class this morning, and it... What was said was that at birth, we abandon our true selves. So the abandonment that happens at birth is the abandonment of our true self. And my question was, if, in fact, as a newborn, I was abandoned by my mother and I abandoned my true self, if that's what everyone does, kind of what are the ramifications of that? Or...
I wouldn't say so much that the true self was abandoned. It's never really abandoned. The real self is always there, but there's a forgetting. But it's actually on the soul level. The soul projects the light of its essence into the body, and that light then produces an energy field that resonates with the information being given by the mother and by the environment and creates a proto-ego out of it. And that proto-ego is not aware of the soul or of the Supreme Self. And because that ego has to deal with an adverse situation, then it gets lost in the fear of abandonment. And as a result of that, it abandons its spiritual nature because it's a luxury. I've got to deal with this. I can't think about God, or I can't, remember myself before I was born, because right now I'm in a difficult jam, right? So I wouldn't take this as some kind of a blame situation. It's just an inherent part of the world drama in which you have to forget in order to again go through the process of rediscovery and the bliss of refinding yourself.
Okay. Right. Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Shinya. Okay. So I have a few things coming up, and I'm wondering how it all relates and how to make sense of it. But the last few days, I guess this should have been happening 10 years ago, but this sort of arising of saying a mantra has become very much a big part of my day. And I think feeling the other day so... I don't know, just that overwhelmedness by the thought, the affects, it was just, okay, and this sort of just going to silence doesn't work. So this, like you, I think, read from Ramana, I wrote it down, that when he talked about just pick one word and focus on that word. But something else happens where it sort of puts the thoughts and the affects into kind of a suspended animation. And raises like an energy and vibration to see things.
That's the purpose of it.
So I'm wondering, because you also talked yesterday about the, I think in reference to Santosha and the unconditional acceptance, seeing the gems in the unbearable knowledge. And so it seems with the mantra and with, kind of a changing, and this is like during the day, like while I'm doing things, right? There's more seeing or kind of watching the character, and what I don't know, because what is finding the gems in the unbearable knowledge? And is it just the character? Also, it's affects and these things. Okay, what also arose in the thinking about the mantra was. What came up was how a child likes to be put to sleep, put to bed, and often it's read to.
Or mama sings a lullaby.
Or something.
You're singing a lullaby to yourself.
I mean, I don't have memories.
Yeah, you're soothing the infant. But that's one of the purposes.
Okay. All right. It's just funny, as we're talking a lot tonight about pain and. Like Steve was an anesthesiologist, and then you're here reading, and when taking it in, and you're reading even can be, like feel soothing, right?
Yeah. Well, you're describing a practice they call japa, right? And obviously it's a well-known Hindu practice, but the same thing is done in all the traditions. The Jesus prayer in Christianity, all of those are mantras, and you're praying to God or singing to God or remembering God, and God is yourself. So you're making a connection to that self that's transcendent of the character that is acting, and the locus of your attention is shifting from the character to the self. So you're no longer identifying so much with the body and with its activities, and therefore the sanskaras of the ego don't erupt so much and create negative feeling states and emotional volatility and all of that. So you can remain much more in a state of equanimity and even enjoy. If you're saying the mantra with love for God, then you'll be in a very joyous state. So it's an excellent practice. And eventually, as Ramana says, the mantra will go on by itself. You won't any longer think, I am saying a mantra, but a mantra just is happening. It literally becomes an automatic process that goes on, and you continue to hear it, right? And then you realize you are just the awareness hearing it, not the person who thought she was saying it. And then you become that which is signified by the mantra, and then it all disappears. Okay? So Ramana says, yeah, you can do it one of two ways. You can reach self-realization through bhakti, which can be through the practice of a mantra or prayer or just simply an attitude in which one's heart is surrendered to God and my life belongs to God and there is only that desire to serve God, and then the relationship of love with God will bring closer and closer connection until union is attained. Or you can realize that the self that the ego is seeking to be free of its suffering is already present as your own awareness, and there is no process that needs to be undertaken. And different temperaments will prefer a different approach. They both lead up the mountain and will equally get you into God consciousness. And there are people who do both. And the only question is how embedded are you in the belief in duality? If it's a very strong belief and that God is outside of you and beyond you, then I think that bhakti approach is necessary. If you realize the kingdom of heaven is within and non-duality is the truth, then it'll be much easier to do it through self-inquiry and without going through any rituals or need for those kinds of prayer activities. But in either case, it is a recognition of the sacredness of consciousness, and that is what you are, and that by purifying your consciousness of all of its contamination through having taken in projections and the imitation of other people's attitudes that are not sacred or holy or good or pure has caused you to create an identity structure that is cynical and nihilistic and or whatever it might be, and your pure awareness, before it was defiled by its environmental embedment, then it's very easy to return to your original nature prior to birth, which is that pure awareness, and realize that you never lost it. You forgot about it, but it's always there because that's who you are, and that's the awareness that creates the illusion that you're in a world, you know, at all. So it is one stop, one step into the void, and you're free. So whether you do it through devotion to God or realization of God as the self, but that is the only real. And the more we get there, the more we're free of suffering. Whether it's from a toothache or from panic attacks or whatever it might be, we will have that freedom and that supernatural power if we are totally surrendered to that.